This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we devote our entire show to a new book called The Trillion Dollar Silencer by Joan Roelofs.
Learn about the ways in which our military-industrial complex pervades all aspects of our lives.
Stay with us. I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
I am civil rights attorney Julie Hurwitz, a partner in the law firm of Goodman, Hurwitz & James, based in Detroit, Michigan, and a board member of the Michigan chapter of the National Lawyers Guild.
As the notion of perpetual war and a militarized society are normalized, notably absent are anti-war protests by faith-based organizations, civil rights groups, academics, and others. A new book, The Trillion Dollar Silencer, details this absence while laying bare the devastation wrought in the United States and abroad by the military-industrial complex. Author Joan Roelofs delves into the pervasive role of military contractors and bases that have come to be economic hubs of their regions. She discusses how state and local governments are intertwined with the Department of Defense, including economic development commissions at all levels. Contracts and grants to universities, colleges, and faculty come from the Department of Defense and its agencies, such as the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. The Minerva Institute funds social scientists for military research. Civilian jobs in the DoD provide opportunities for scientists, engineers, policy analysts, and others. The Reserve Officers Training Corps, or ROTC, programs are subsidized also by the DoD. In addition to businesses large and small, nonprofits receive DoD contracts and grants, including environmental and charitable organizations such as the Nature Conservancy and Goodwill Industries. Individuals, arts institutions, charities, churches, and universities share in the profitability of military-related investments. Pension funds for public and private employees and unions are replete with military stocks. In other words, the military-industrial complex is so embedded in our political economy that it has become virtually impossible to find any sector of our society that is not intertwined with militarism. Joining us today is Joan Roelofs, Professor Emerita of Political Science at Keene State College. She teaches in the Cheshire Academy for Lifelong Learning and writes for scholarly and political publications. Joan is the author of Foundations and Public Policy, The Mask of Pluralism, and Greening Cities, Building Just and Sustainable Communities. She has been an anti-war activist ever since she protested the Korean War. Joan, welcome to Law and Disorder, and congratulations on this comprehensive and important book.
Thank you.
Joan, how did you come to be interested in the topic of militarization, and how do you define that?
Well, first I will define militarism. This is the idea that military solutions to many conflicts are the best, are proper, and are effective. Militarization is the penetration of military values, processes, and institutions into civilian life, as well as their expansion into the national budget. I was always opposed to war. One of my major research areas is the political power of the nonprofit sector. So I started researching its connection to militarization.
If you could, Joan, how can you explain to us how did World Wars I and II and the Cold War contribute to the militarization of the United States?
Okay. Militarism was always the dominant culture of this country. But a counterculture of pacifism existed and once was respectable. Enlightenment thought and radical Christianity, as for example in the 19th century communitarian societies, were strongly pacifist. Until 1914, anti-war theologians, artists and writers, and even politicians and business people were held in high esteem by the general population. Social science was slowly developing with the goal of producing happiness for humanity. That was up until the First World War, where pacifism was still respectable. But the dominant culture of scholars and universities, even those of religious universities, celebrated the extermination of indigenous peoples, the War of Independence, the Civil War, and the colonial expansion resulting from the Spanish-American War. So militarism was always the dominant culture. But after 1914, pacifism lost its respectability.
Joan, what are the silencers that you refer to in the trillion-dollar silencer, and how do they operate?
Well, first of all, they're silencers of people and of organizations are silenced by fear, by propaganda, and by distractions. But they are also silenced by interests, and this is what I write about. These interests have to be taken into account by those who want to change things. For example, white-collar, blue-collar scientists and engineers can get good jobs in the military-industrial complex, even though it would be better for all if such jobs were in industry satisfying human needs. This is where we are now, and anti-war people have to figure out how to deal with it. Also, there are many people who have had relatives in the military, and they still regard them as war heroes, or people whose grandchildren have now gotten jobs in the military, especially if they are granddaughters now working in the Navy, advisory capacities, or as engineers, or managerial, you know, good, really good jobs. So people don't want to criticize the military. And also, if you have friends who have these relatives, you try not to say anything about them, about what's going on in the world in front of them. It's one of the things that silences people. There are many things, and there's so much propaganda, but I don't write about that because other people have written quite a bit about it. The interest is the part I concentrate on.
I've noticed that any time anyone has said that they or a family member are in the military, the first thing we're trained to do is say thank you for your service, right? Joan, what is the unconventional warfare that you write about, and what is its role in the penetration of the military into civilian life that is so pervasive?
Unconventional warfare refers to covert operations, which are often carried out by the Department of Defense Special Operations Forces. That includes the Navy SEALs, the Green Berets, and other branches of the military have their own special forces. And it's all organized into something called the Special Operations Command. Now, the activities include assassinations, culture revolutions, propaganda, and even humanitarian assistance. And here's how some ways that it impedes the civilian world. The U.S. military has offered pet clinics in Latin America and dental clinics in Africa to gain information and confidence of local people. If they appeared in their military guise, they wouldn't be so welcome. But here they come in and they're going to help people's pets. They have veterinarians who come in, dentists come in to deal with people's teeth. There's also much collaboration with paramilitary groups in other countries. Nick Turse has done a lot of reporting on special operations forces, so anyone who's interested should go look for his articles. It's T-U-R-S-E.
Joan, you devote a fascinating chapter to military bases and installations, and you note that some U.S. sites are the size of cities. What is the relevance of military spatial occupation?
Well, the spatial occupation is quite great. I actually have maps in my book that show some of their testing and training lands, and also along the shores, underwater areas. But Fort Bragg, North Carolina, is the world's largest military base. It has been called an all-American city by the National Civic League. Anthropologist Catherine Lutz has written a book about the way it has shaped its community of Fayetteville, North Carolina. The book is Homefront, strongly recommended. And it also happens to be the headquarters of the U.S. Special Operations Command. And there are many,
wow,
many bases in this country which are huge. And around those bases, there are people who are selling food, housing, entertainment, car rentals, motels, very important economically, and very many civilian workers work on those bases.
Along those veins, could you please talk a little bit about the Department of Defense's so-called civilian encroachment problem and the DOD's readiness and environmental protection and integration program?
Yes, this is something that isn't very well known. Actually, the Department of Defense has 6 or 7 different environmental agencies. But this particular program is to deal with 2 threats to the military. The threat to their ability to test, train, and operate. Incompatible land uses is one threat. And environmental laws protecting endangered species is another threat. They use the word threat to their military operations. So the problems are to be resolved by the RAPI program. And among the threatening encroachments are lights from residential and commercial development that reduce the effectiveness of night vision training, restrictions imposed because of noise, dust, and smoke of military activities, civilian use of the frequency spectrum, communication towers, wind turbines, highways, and energy transmission lines, construction or drones that enable observation into sensitive mission areas, foreign ownership of adjacent properties, that's regarded as a threat because they might be spying, acoustic monitoring in sensitive Navy areas, development in an explosive standoff buffering area or accident potential zones. These are accident potential zones that would be in civilian areas. And also land development that pushes endangered species onto military lands. Those are all the threats from civilians to the military. And this is in the United States, this program. So the program creates buffer zones and partnerships that include private conservation groups. And the Nature Conservancy is a major participant with millions of dollars in contracts to help them create these buffer zones and protect endangered species, put the endangered species in the buffer zones where maybe there would be some accidents, but okay. Also involved are the Audubon societies, Ducks Unlimited, zoos, along with universities and state and local governments. Other federal departments are involved, including Homeland Security, Energy, Interior, Agriculture, and Commerce. The military doesn't mind agricultural activities, but they want to make sure that the kind of agricultural activities won't affect their testing and training and live bombing and war games and things like that. Certain kinds of agriculture might, perhaps crop dusting or... Now, and the partners also would include local economic development corporations, regional associations, and the National Council of State Legislatures. And if you want to find out more about this amazing program, all you have to do is Google Readiness and Environmental Protection and Integration Program. There are lots of maps and describes the programs in most states to avoid the encroachment of civilians on military areas. The Navy has been accused of using too much fuel. Of course, the military, U.S. military, is the largest consumer of fuel in the world. One of their fleets, they used beef tallow as a fuel, except for the part of the fleet that was nuclear-powered. But otherwise, they're using beef tallow, and they got some award for being so environmentally pure. Instead of using regular fuel oil, they use beef tallow. I mean, that's just a weird thing, but it's true.
Now, Joan, a good part of your book is dedicated to the issue of anti-war protest. How are local communities protesting encroachments such as toxic contamination?
Well, they actually do. There are quite a lot of protests, and they're not just by the communities, but also by military families and civilian workers on the bases. And the Defense Department has now acknowledged many of these, especially the at Camp Lejeune toxic contamination of the whole water system, underground water system. They have acknowledged it, and they say now Congress has passed a law saying people are entitled to compensation for being damaged.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a very slow process, and they are trying to clean up certain things, but there are places where cleanup may not ever succeed. However, there are now thousands of law firms that are trying to help victims gain restitution. And I have gotten a lot of messages from them because I researched this subject. And I keep getting messages on my Facebook page. Do you want to sue the government because of the pollution at Camp Lejeune? And there were many, many different law firms just trying to get something out of this Camp Lejeune contamination process. It's quite amazing. So one can also, of course, study the relationship between law firms and military pollution. One could probably write a whole book about it.
I want to circle back to your comments earlier in explaining sort of the sort of tentacles, the number of connections between the military and various agencies and environmental groups and local governments and federal departments. And in your book, you write, and I quote, "The military budget's economic payouts help to gain support or silence concerning our worldwide bases and special operations, warfare, conventional or unconventional, and the gradual militarization of everyday life." And I end quote. Can you explain a little bit more the societal impact of the military handing out contracts for approximately 75% of its military functions?
Well, it puts a huge number of people benefiting from the military budget in some way or having some connections or working with them. So many. This is also true of civilian budget also contracts a lot of health care, social services, and other things. But, so all of these businesses, very small businesses, tiny businesses, are subcontractors or have direct contracts with the military. Of course, they're not going to start complaining about what the military is doing all over the world. It just, there will be a few people who do speak out. I know that. But I'm talking about the majority of the people who have one kind of contract or another. You don't hear them in the anti-war movement. There'll be very, very few. And it's so widespread. I made a map of the military industrial complex in New Hampshire, which is an interactive map to show all the different ways that the military has connections with civilian life.
Joan, I'm actually from New Hampshire. I was surprised to read in your book about the number of contracts there, for example, to manufacture cribs for Army childcare centers. And I understand neighboring Vermont, makes headstones for Arlington National Cemetery. I had no idea about the extent of these contracts. Can you just elaborate a bit?
Well, I can tell you, in New Hampshire, I particularly looked at that. In 2020, these were the top 10 contractors in New Hampshire. BAE Systems was the first one. It gets a huge amount of the money. And many people who live here have never heard of BAE. And these are educated people. They're politicians. They're activists. They don't even know what, when I say BAE, they have no idea what I'm talking about. L3 Harris Technologies, Cobham, Creer, Sig Sauer, a German firm, Safran Optics, L&C Protec, Red River Computer, Elbit Systems is an Israeli firm. It's one of the top 10 contractors. And then there are other military expenditures, such as the Department of Defense personnel themselves, the National Guard subsidies, university contracts, ROTC and junior ROTC allotments, and base remediation. These are also economically significant and, of course, contribute to the silence of anti-war protests. And often, of course, they cheer military endeavors. Junior ROTC, they're not told that they're joining a military organization. They're told they're joining an organization that promotes leadership and cooperation and self-development. They de-emphasize what the military actually does. In other kinds of contractors in New Hampshire include Warwick Mills, which is now producing technical textiles, such as those used in body armor. It was a cotton mill in 1888. Medium and small businesses, such as Portsmouth Blind and Shade. Velcro is a New Hampshire business. They have military contractors. Greenfeet Enterprises, which is a nonprofit organization specialized in mountain rescue training. And they have contracts with the Naval Special Operations Warfare. Child care centers, heating oil companies, landscapers, carpenters, appliance dealers, and others get some of the pie. In Keene, there's a company that produces juvenile furniture. And they weren't doing too well, just like all the other furniture companies in the United States, because a lot of inexpensive furniture is outsourced. It's made in China or Thailand or someplace else. But they got a contract a number of years ago to make cribs for Army child care centers because there were new regulations for safety of cribs. So they had to get rid of the old ones. And this brought this company a new lease on life. I am amazed all the time at how little the people of New Hampshire know about what is all around them and how many of the local businesses and organizations have ties one way or another to the military.
If you're just joining us, my co-host Heidi Boghossian and I, Julie Hurwitz, are talking with author Joan Roelofs about her amazing book, The Trillion Dollar Silencer. I want to circle back. You mentioned one of the examples you gave is contracts with universities. MIT, an educational institution, as you point out, is the 38th largest U.S. military contractor in the nation. And the same, I think you've also identified a number of philanthropic organizations as examples. Could you please discuss the extent to which charitable health and other nonprofits contract with the Defense Department and how this relationship and the image of DOD philanthropy is another silencer?
Yes, well, the DOD philanthropy is primarily giving surplus equipment to a large list of organizations, including Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts. And they also practically donate surplus equipment to state governments. They give them away at very bargain prices, and that you could consider philanthropy too. But as far as the contracts are concerned, this is a huge topic. I think anyone interested in that should read my book with a lot of details, and they should do more research on this themselves. And one very important source is the Government Contracts Database. This is put out by our government. It's usaspending.gov. And that includes all kinds of contracts, not only inside the United States, but contracts with foreign governments, foreign universities, and foreign nonprofit organizations and foreign businesses. The way you can use this database is you can filter for what you're looking for. So you could look for universities in France or all foreign universities contracting with the Department of Defense. All the other government departments are on that database too, but I was looking especially for the Department of Defense. And you see what they're contracting with, and that's how I got a lot of my information. And I wrote the book to encourage people to do more research on this and to make this picture much more visible to everyone else in the country, people around them. It's very, very hard to do that. I find the mainstream press is mostly silence on it, but also the local press doesn't talk about what's going on locally. My local newspaper doesn't mention that the local tiny airport is used for training, military training of National Guard, National Air Guard. And people complain, they say, why am I hearing all this? But you don't read about it in the newspaper. There's so many things. In fact, I was talking to an employee of a peace organization in New Hampshire, and he was not aware that New Boston is now part of the Space Force. There was an Air Force base at New Boston, which was a bombing range. Now it's still an Air Force base, part of the Space Force, but now it's electronic communications type of thing and part of the Space Force. This person didn't even know that there was a base in New Boston, which is very near me. So real problem is getting this word out to people who don't read my books, who don't use the internet, who don't look at Counterpunch, which is where I have a lot of articles, people who don't even read the mainstream press or get any news at all. There are a lot of people who don't want to know.
Joan, we applaud you wholeheartedly for bringing these issues to the fore. Could you talk for a moment about Project Camelot and other initiatives that many in academia have protested?
Well, CAMELOT was a counterinsurgency program that employed social scientists to collect cultural and social process information in foreign countries. And mostly anthropologists were involved, but some other social scientists too. And there was a protest in the American Anthropological Association. Anthropologist Catherine Lutz wrote, and I'll quote, "Counterinsurgency planners tell us that human thinking and effect are the primary terrain which must be mapped and conquered in order to defeat or convert the enemy, or to at least render the surrounding population neutral in that struggle of wills which is called counterinsurgency war. Human Terrain System of 2007, which engaged social scientists in obtaining ethnographic data in Iraq and Afghanistan, was also protested. And in the 1960s, radical caucuses were created in many academic disciplines, which were inspired by the U.S. wars and covert actions. For example, in political science, it was called the Caucus for New Political Science, but many of the disciplines had a radical caucus, mostly inspired by covert actions by the Vietnam War. So there has been protest, but the universities are very silent now. There's a little bit, but very little, anti-war. They protest tuition costs or other kinds of things, but there's not much anti-war protest. It's very small amount in universities. Religious organizations are quite quiet, too.
I would like to ask you to comment a little bit more on sort of the demise or the decline of anti-war protests. Having been one of those protesters myself during the 70s, can you talk a little bit more about how the role of militarization and militarism has contributed to the decline of anti-war protests on campuses around the country?
Well, first of all, protest against war, empire, and capitalism was channeled with major assistance from foundation funding into identity politics and non-governmental organizations. And I wrote a book about this called Foundations and Public Policy, published by SUNY Press. That's one part of the picture. And then universities had become used to the juicy military contracts that enabled the construction of new facilities and new hires. Students were attracted to the well-funded departments and programs, which became even more attractive when heavy student loan debt became the norm. And now it's a case in universities that so many programs are geared to how are you going to earn a good living when you get out and pay back your school debt, and students don't want to take any risks. The military offers a lot of jobs to graduates of colleges and universities.
And in fact, Joan, you might be interested to know that a month or so ago, we actually did a segment on junior ROTC in schools and how some high schools are automatically enrolling students in these programs, and it's difficult to opt out if you don't want to be part of them.
It was surprisingly an expose in the New York Times about the junior ROTC. In New Hampshire, the junior ROTC has had live ammunition training at the Fall Mountain School, not too far from here. Some of the parents have protested. Junior ROTC are mostly, especially in low-income and minority areas. Often all children are forced into it, and it's very difficult to get out of it.
Joan, you note also that the Department of Defense funds a worldwide network of research. How is that, and what is the impact on other nations' institutions?
Well, many universities and institutes throughout the world are heavily funded by the Department of Defense, and that is, you can find in the contracts database too that I mentioned. But more investigation is needed to find out what impact that has had on foreign universities and also on the general culture and politics of foreign countries. If I had another lifetime, I would write a book about that. But I haven't seen a lot of information, and I suspect that's one of the reasons why there is so much acquiescence to U.S. militarism in, say, in Western Europe, where there used to be social democratic parties that were interested in peaceful solutions. But now they're as hawk-like as any of the others. In fact, some of the right-wing parties are much more interested in peaceful solutions than the left-wing parties. So I don't know. This is an area to investigate. And again, one of the purposes of my book is to get more people to do this kind of investigation. It's too much for one person.
Joan, the work you are doing to bring this important information to light cannot be overstated. We are so appreciative of you. You write in your book that, and I quote, many have been indoctrinated to believe that militarism is normal and necessary. Those who see the necessity of change for planetary survival, justice, and sanity need to become aware of all the ways that the military, industrial, congressional, almost everything complex is being sustained. Our political system, despite its well-publicized and expensive elections, does not afford citizens much democratic control over policies and hardly any over foreign policy. End quote. That is so true. And that being said, what are your thoughts on what citizens and our listeners can do to address militarism?
Well, as a first step, making militarization more visible. And that isn't easy. I have had a lot of trouble trying to get any information about my book into the media in New Hampshire that isn't alternative media, the mainstream media of New Hampshire. They don't want to know about it, but it's possible to get more information. One of the things you can do is write letters to the editor. Those they will sometimes publish. But again, it's people might try to speak to their neighbors or people they know in organizations or churches, because there's so little awareness of what's going on in the world or the militarization that's right next to them. And of course, the mainstream and local media are complicit in this silence. So the anti-war community needs to confront all the silence and support that comes from the interests that I have described. Then they have to put time, energy, and brains into figuring out how it can be changed. I know what kind of a society I'd like and what would be good. One of the things is to have a civilian department in the federal government so the Army engineers are not doing recreational lakes at the same time that they're building bases in the Middle East. Completely separated, and provide jobs through a civilian department, through something like the Civilian Conservation Corps, perhaps even have a requirement for all to participate in something like that, a national service requirement. I know those things might help, but I don't know how any changes can come about, given the Congress and what it requires to be elected. You have to have big money to get elected to Congress in most places. There are a few cities where you can get progressive people to put a few progressive people into Congress, but in most of the country, it's almost impossible. The people who have the money are the ones who are able to run for election. I think people have to put their time, energy, and brains into figuring out how to change the system. More people have to be working on that. Maybe there's a way. And people are doing demonstrations. That helps. Divestment projects helps to make it visible. But how to actually change things is a tricky thing.
Joan, I think that an important first step is for our listeners to read your incredible book, The Trillion Dollar Silencer, and spread the word, as you had suggested earlier. How can listeners follow your work?
Well, I have a website on WordPress. It's Joan Roloff's one word, .wordpress.com. And I have some of my work there. I have written a lot of articles in Counterpunch online, counterpunch.org. But if people want to do research, I would be very happy to help them. And they can contact me via Facebook. And that's one way I would definitely respond if they contacted me and gave me their email address and asked me a question about how to do more research. I'd be happy to do that. I would love to know how to get more into the mainstream about what's going on. That is hard. And, you know, I have only so much time to do things. I need more help on this.
Well, we need to get you some interns, Joan, and I think that is an incredible offer that you've just made. What a wonderful discussion this has been. You are a hero to us. We wish you all the best with your book, with mainstreaming it, and with getting this important series of messages out on this topic.
And thank you for hosting me.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Yes, I'm not thinking about this life of mine. I'm thinking about this life of mine. Thinking about all my trouble and about all of my good time. Did you ever get to thinking and see what a fool you've been? See what a fool you've been. Seen all of your mistakes, any low-down shape you're in.
Listeners may be aware of the well-known speech that President Dwight Eisenhower gave when he left office. It talked about the dangers of a military-industrial complex. We go now to hear part of that historic speech. Let's take a listen.
Throughout America's adventure in free government, our basic purposes have been to keep the peace, to foster progress in human achievement, and to enhance liberty, dignity, and integrity among peoples and among nations. To strive for less would be unworthy of a free and religious people. Any failure traceable to arrogance, or our lack of comprehension or readiness to sacrifice, would inflict upon us grievous hurt, both at home and abroad. Progress toward these noble goals is persistently threatened by the conflict now engulfing the world. It commands our whole attention, absorbs our very beings. We face a hostile ideology, global in scope, atheistic in character, ruthless in purpose and insidious in method. Unhappily, the danger it poses promises to be of indefinite duration. To meet it successfully, there is call for not so much the emotional and transitory sacrifices of crisis, but rather those which enable us to carry forward steadily, surely, and without complaint, the burdens of a prolonged and complex struggle with liberty the stake. Only thus shall we remain, despite every provocation, on our charted course toward permanent peace and human betterment. Crises there will continue to be. In meeting them, whether foreign or domestic, great or small, there is a recurring temptation to feel that some spectacular and costly action could become the miraculous solution to all current difficulties. A huge increase in newer elements of our defenses, development of unrealistic programs to cure every ill in agriculture, a dramatic expansion in basic and applied research. These and many other possibilities, each possibly promising in itself, may be suggested as the only way to the road we wish to travel. But each proposal must be weighed in the light of a broader consideration, the need to maintain balance in and among national programs. Balance between the private and the public economy. Balance between the cost and hoped for advantages. Balance between the clearly necessary and the comfortably desirable. Balance between our essential requirements as a nation and the duties imposed by the nation upon the individual. Balance between actions of the moment and the national welfare of the future. Good judgment seeks balance and progress. Lack of it eventually finds imbalance and frustration. The record of many decades stands as proof that our people and their government have, in the main, understood these truths and have responded to them well in the face of threat and stress. But threats, new in kind or degree, constantly arise. Of these, I mention two only. A vital element in keeping the peace is our military establishment. Our arms must be mighty, ready for instant action, so that no potential aggressor may be tempted to risk his own destruction. Our military organization today bears little relation to that known of any of my predecessors in peacetime, or indeed by the fighting men of World War II or Korea. Until the latest of our world conflicts, the United States had no armaments industry. American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well. But we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense. We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. We annually spend on military security alone more than the net income of all United States corporations. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together. Akin to and largely responsible for the sweeping changes in our industrial military posture has been the technological revolution during recent decades. In this revolution, research has become central. It also becomes more formalized, complex, and costly. A steadily increasing share is conducted for, by, or at the direction of the federal government. Today, the solitary inventor, tinkering in his shop, has been overshadowed by task forces of scientists in laboratories and testing fields. In the same fashion, the free university, historically the fountainhead of free ideas and scientific discovery, has experienced a revolution in the conduct of research. Partly because of the huge costs involved, a government contract becomes virtually a substitute for intellectual curiosity. For every old blackboard, there are now hundreds of new electronic computers. The prospect of domination of the nation's scholars by federal employment, project allocations, and the power of money is ever present and is gravely to be regarded. Yet in holding scientific research and discovery in respect, as we should, we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific, technological elite. It is the task of statesmanship to mold, to balance, and to integrate these and other forces, new and old, within the principles of our democratic system, ever aiming toward the supreme goals of our free society. Another factor in maintaining balance involves the element of time. As we peer into society's future, we, you and I, and our government must avoid the impulse to live only for today, plundering for our own ease and convenience the precious resources of tomorrow. We cannot mortgage the material assets of our grandchildren without risking the loss also of their political and spiritual heritage. We want democracy to survive for all generations to come, not to become the insolvent phantom of tomorrow. During the long lane of the history yet to be written, America knows that this world of ours, ever growing smaller, must avoid becoming a community of dreadful fear and hate, and be instead a proud confederation of mutual trust and respect. Such a confederation must be one of equals. The weakest must come to the conference table with the same confidence as do we, protected as we are by our moral, economic, and military strength. That table, though scarred by many past frustrations, cannot be abandoned for the certainty agony of disarmament of the battlefield. Disarmament with mutual honor and confidence is a continuing imperative. Together we must learn how to compose differences, not with arms, but with intellect and decent purpose. Because this need is so sharp and apparent, I confess that I lay down my official responsibilities in this field with a definite sense of disappointment. As one who has witnessed the horror and the lingering sadness of war, as one who knows that another war could utterly destroy this civilization, which has been so slowly and painfully built over thousands of years, I wish I could say tonight that a lasting peace is in sight. Happily, I can say that war has been avoided. Steady progress toward our ultimate goal has been made, but so much remains to be done. As a private citizen, I shall never cease to do what little I can to help the world advance along that road.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.